This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Flashpoint neighborhood in the occupied Al-Quds once again becomes the scene of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians. The Russian president warns against provocative Western speculation about Moscow's imminent invasion of Ukraine. Also ahead, British government's move to raise energy prices and taxes is causing public anger. Welcome to the program. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas issues a stern warning after Israeli troops and settlers attack people in a flashpoint neighborhood in the occupied east of Al-Quds. Hamas has blasted the overnight attack on Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood as a flagrant violation. Resistance group says Israel is playing with fire and will face consequences for such aggression. Hamas is calling on Palestinians across the entire occupied territories to mobilize in support of the people in Sheikh Jarrah. The neighborhood has been the scene of frequent clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians. Dozens of families living there face possible expulsion from their homes in favor of Israeli settlers. Washington throwing the ball into Moscow's court, saying the path to diplomacy over Ukraine is open, but also warning that a response will be tough if Russia moves to invade its Western neighbor.
A diplomatic path to resolving this crisis, a crisis created by the unprovoked massing of Russian forces all around Ukraine, that diplomatic path remains open. The way for Moscow to show that it wants to pursue that path is simple. It should de-escalate rather than escalate. If Moscow chooses the path of aggression and further invades Ukraine, the response of the United States and our allies will be swift, it will be united, it will be severe.
Blinken added that the risk of a Russian incursion is high enough to justify the evacuation of much of the U.S. embassy staff from Kyiv. Moscow has denounced Washington's peak hysteria over Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron that talks of invasion are, in his words, provocative speculation. Putin warned that this approach can lead to a conflict in Ukraine. He also separately told U.S. President Joe Biden that Washington has failed to give a substantial answer to Russia's security concerns. They include NATO's eastward expansion and its deployment of offensive forces in Ukraine.
Political commentator John Bosnich says Russia has reiterated that it is not planning on invading Ukraine, and if the U.S. and the West are worried about an invasion, they should provide evidence for such a concern.
There's no justification for statements about an attack coming in 1 hour or 3 hours or tomorrow afternoon or anything like that. If this is what the United States and its NATO allies are trying to do, to incite fear in their own populations, then that's what they're achieving. But of that fear, nothing good can come. Russia has been making it very, very clear that they're not planning to invade. If the West is that worried about an invasion, then maybe they should prove the evidence that they're using to make those claims. The people of the region on both sides are all the victims of current pre-warfare psychological operations. But the far more damaging and unsettling operation is the one being conducted by the United States and its NATO allies, who are goading the war on, who are threatening a war at any moment, and yet saying that they will not intervene in any way. So these elements are definitely stoking the fires of war. And since war is the main business for most of the NATO countries, the military-industrial complex is the main business, then they're just stoking the fires of their own economy at the expense of the Russians and of the Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainians and ethnic Russians in the country of Ukraine.
The United States says it will reopen its embassy on the Solomon Islands as Washington seeks to expand its presence in the Pacific region. Washington has not had an embassy there since 1993 and is represented by a consulate that is directed from the U.S. Embassy in Papua New Guinea. Senior U.S. officials have said the move is aimed at countering China's growing influence in the Pacific. They say Beijing plans to forge military ties in the region. In December, China said it would send police advisors and non-lethal gear to the Solomon Islands following deadly riots a month before. The U.S. Secretary of State is now in Fiji for talks with regional leaders. Washington is promising more diplomatic and security resources to the Pacific nations. Now, hundreds of people in the British capital, London, have taken to the streets to protest against the skyrocketing cost of living. The government's recent decision to raise energy prices and taxes threatens to push millions of Britons to choose between heating and eating. Said Pureza has sent us a report from London.
Coming out in the cold to make sure everyone gets to keep their home warm in winter amid the soaring cost of living in Britain. The government here blames the skyrocketing cost of living on global energy price hikes. These protesters, however, say it's the big companies that have made windfall profits who should foot the bill, not them.
Shell made £14 billion of profit. £14 billion. And BP made £10 billion. Why not take some of that and use that to pay for it?
They need to subsidise those bills. Why not? They've already written off £9 billion on PPE. They've written off £4.9 billion on bad debt, bad COVID loans, bounce-back loans. So subsidise us.
The country's energy regulator, Ofgem, has risen the price cap in place to protect the people by more than 50%. The government has introduced a loan scheme to help out, up to $270 per household. But experts say the underlying drivers remain.
There are already a lot of people struggling to keep their homes warm, particularly those who live in houses that are not properly insulated. And the recent price hikes are expected to push as many as a quarter of UK households into fuel poverty.
Rising bills will affect millions. But they'll bite the hardest for those with fewer choices. Add to that a tax rise set to kick in come April.
It doesn't have to be tax, tax, tax all the time. We need to have something to be given to us as well. It's like benefits are not there anymore for us. So you go to work and you're still ending up being in a situation that, oh, where should I go? I can't afford this, I can't afford that. And every year is situation just getting worse and worse.
Someone young and starting off, you know, ready to buy a house and earn a living, it does make me quite worried, especially living in London. Cost of living keeps on rising. wage is not really reflected in that. So, I mean, I am quite worried about my future and the high cost of living.
Millions of British households will soon face energy bills of more than $2,000 a year. Whether that much can be managed depends on how much you earn and where you live. Saeed Purza, London.
France's Yellow Vests led an anti-government freedom convoy to Paris, taking a page from the book of protesters in Canada. However, Paris responded with an immediate crackdown, and while it's not clear if France's freedom convoy is finished or it's only just begun, Ramin Mazahiri has more from Paris.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy, emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer. And this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019.
We marched as Yellow Vests for 2 years, and we are still Yellow Vests today. We all saw that nothing changed. The cost of living is too expensive. We can pay our bills at the end of the month. We don't want this government and the violence anymore.
The Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
When it comes to war on Yemen, the UAE, which is part of the Saudi-led coalition, is not holding back, while the Yemeni army has begun a new retaliatory campaign against the United Arab Emirates. The Sheikhdom has increased its purchase of military hardware. This report looks at Abu Dhabi's involvement in the Yemen war and whether the new Yemeni operations will force the Sheikhdom to change its course.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support.
Abu Dhabi is scrambling to boost its air defenses following a string of Yemeni attacks on the UAE's vital infrastructure. It's following in the footsteps of Saudi Arabia and is turning to Western powers, like the U.S., to supply it with military hardware and weapons, but reports suggest that Riyadh is running critically low on ammunition to keep its missile systems operational.
The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support. At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
A standoff between the Canadian police and anti-vaccine protesters continues in the capital, Ottawa. Authorities say those who do not respect the rule of law will get arrested. The warning comes hours after the start of an operation by the police to end the protesters' blockade on the Ambassador Bridge, the country's busiest border crossing with the United States. Truckers have cut access to three vital Canadian crossings in protest against the government's COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. The presidents of the U.S. and Canada have called for an end to the blockade, and a judge has ruled accordingly. Canadian officials say security forces or security officers have been deployed to some other areas, including the city of Toronto and New Brunswick province, to avoid similar unrest.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight. Some of the documents reportedly taken by former President Donald Trump to his Florida Mar-a-Lago residence was clearly marked as classified, with some listed as top secret, according to the Washington Post. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Aaron McDade, writing for Newsweek magazine. The piece is titled, Top Secret Trump Records Among Those Taken to Mar-a-Lago, Report. So Some of the documents reportedly taken by former President Donald Trump to his Florida Mar-a-Lago residence were clearly marked as classified, with some listed as top secret, according to the Washington Post. The number of top secret documents is unknown, but the Washington Post also reported that some documents were marked with classifications above top secret, which is information that very few high-level officials would be authorized to view. Last month, the National Archives and Records Administration reportedly assisted in retrieving as many as 15 boxes of documents from the Florida resort, according to the Washington Post. The National Archives denied their involvement in a raid of Mar-a-Lago, but said earlier this week in a statement that they coordinated with Donald Trump's representative to arrange the return of documents not previously turned over to Washington in accordance with the Presidential Records Act. Representatives from the National Archives discovered the top-secret classifications and have requested the FBI's assistance in reviewing them, the Washington Post reported. Included in the documents returned to the National Archives were letters sent between Donald Trump and North Korean President Kim Jong-un. The top-secret documents are being stored by the Justice Department while it is determined if the transport of the documents from Washington to Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida warrants a larger investigation into the record-keeping practices of the Trump administration, according to the Washington Post. It is clear that a normal and routine process is being weaponized by anonymous, politically motivated government sources to peddle fake news, Donald Trump spokesperson Taylor Budowich told the Washington Post. The only entity with the ability to credibly dispute this false reporting, the National Archives, is providing no comment. Top secret classifications are given to documents that contain information, the unauthorized disclosure of which reasonably could be expected to cause exceptionally grave damage to national security, according to the National Archives Information Security Oversight Office. The documents and Donald Trump's habits of dealing with them have gained increased attention in recent weeks after it was reported that some of the documents sent by the National Archives to the House Committee investigating the events of 6th of January 2021 arrived and looked like they had been torn apart and taped back together again, the Washington Post reported. The documents were turned over to the House Committee following several legal challenges from Donald Trump that ended with the Supreme Court rejecting his attempts to keep the documents sealed. It was also revealed on Thursday, 10th of February, that White House staff occasionally found toilets in the building clogged with what was discovered to be crumpled-up pieces of paper, with many believing Donald Trump attempted to flush documents down the toilet, according to reporting on New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman's upcoming book on Trump. The controversy surrounding Donald Trump's handling of government documents continues to build. The former president is reportedly terrified of an accusation that he would periodically attempt to flush papers down the toilet when he was in office. The allegation is detailed in the upcoming book, Confidence Man, by Maggie Haberman, a White House correspondent for the New York Times. It's another example of Donald Trump's alleged habit of destroying documents during his time in office, a blatant, repeated violation of the Presidential Records Act. New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, who has covered Donald Trump since 2011, reportedly states in her book that multiple Trump administration staffers discovered pieces of paper lodged in lavatory, and they believed that the then president had tried to flush them.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Communique.
Iran is celebrating the 43rd anniversary of its Islamic Revolution. The uprising in 1979 is without question one of the most consequential events in modern political history. It not only changed Iran, but Iran's neighbors, the entire region, the whole planet. Iran's revolution, true popular uprising, it had one of the highest rates of participation in history, rivaling even the French Revolution, and continues to be a defining moment in world politics. Making it even more intriguing is not just how it affected Iran domestically, but equally Iran's immediate and distant neighbors. So what makes this revolution so substantial and so unique? How did Iran go from being a key U.S. ally to foe? What are the values of the revolution? What can we learn from them? And how does Iran's revolution translate into a powerful foreign policy which helps those struggling against imperialism and oppression? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. I think Iran is one of the most misunderstood countries in the Western world today. There's so much propaganda, Islamophobia, so many things that the media get wrong and which people end up internalizing. Most Americans probably only know one thing about the Iranian Revolution, which is the U.S. Embassy takeover. And even then, it's just stuff from movies like Argo or something. That's not enough. It's nowhere near enough. Iran's revolution is a much, much bigger issue than just that. The Islamic Revolution completely changed Iran's character and makeup as a country, and even the region itself. We're talking about such a seismic shift that we're still living through the effects of this revolution to this day. Now, most of the time, people tend to look at a revolution by analyzing it from a domestic point of view, by looking at it internally. But Iran's revolution is much bigger than that. It has far-reaching effects that go well beyond its borders. This popular uprising changed everything from Iran's position as a key U.S. ally to the entire geopolitical makeup of the Middle East. It puts Iran at the center of international affairs. And it's very important for people to understand the mindset, the ideology, the values behind this revolution. A recurring theme that we see is the idea of oppressed versus oppressor. Iran's revolution is all about the downtrodden, the underdog, the oppressed rising up and vanquishing their oppressor. It's poetic justice in the form of an Islamic democratic republic. So let's go through a brief recap of Iran's history leading up to the revolution to understand the driving force behind the uprising in 1979. Now, this goes without saying, Iranians are a very proud people and their civilization dates back literally thousands and thousands of years. But if you look at Iran in the early 20th century, it was very different from how it looks today. Back then, Iran was ruled by the Qajar and then the Pahlavi dynasty. In 1908, oil was discovered in Iran. A British company called Burma Oil proceeded to create a subsidiary called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. This Anglo-Persian company installed its first pipeline in 1909, and it built an enormous refinery in Abadan, which was completed in 1912. This marked the beginning of the British plundering Iranian oil for the next decade. Now, you might know this company by its current name, British Petroleum, or BP. Now, at the time, Winston Churchill convinced the British government to buy an ownership share in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company in 1915, and he transitioned the Royal Navy's fleets from coal to petroleum. Iran was, of course, being taken advantage of. It was given crumbs by the British. Iran only received 16% of the revenue. Not only that, but this percentage was calculated secret by the British, with the Iranians never being allowed to see the book. And to add insult to injury, this is after the British government had deducted tax paid to the British government. So it became very clear to Iranians they were being swindled and ripped off by the British. Now, after World War II, a man named Mohammad Mossadegh changed all of this. Mossadegh was appointed prime minister in 1951 after being elected by the Mejlis, Iran's parliament. Mossadegh was very popular among the people, and he proceeded to nationalize Iran's oil. This includes the oil refinery at Abadan, which, keep in mind, at the time, the largest oil refinery in the world. The response to this by the British and the Americans was to stage a coup and get rid of Mossadegh. That's what usually happens when you nationalize your country's resources and refuse to hand them over to European colonial power. The operation to topple Mossadegh was called Operation Boot by the British. Meanwhile, the Americans, who were helping them in this endeavor, referred to it as Operation Ajax. The goal was to oust Mossadegh, reinstall the Shah, and retake the oil. And while people often attribute the coup of 1953 to the CIA, and that's partly true, the role of the British and British intelligence is equally important. Mossadegh's chief of police, for example, was kidnapped, tortured, and executed by Britain's foreign intelligence, MI6. Now, once the coup was over and they had gotten rid of Mossadegh, the British and the Americans moved quickly to help the Shah establish and train the SAVAK, Iran's secret police. The SAVAK were trained by the CIA. The CIA taught them how to repress dissidents, activists, and anyone who opposed the Shah. And this is remembered collectively in Iran as a period of immense struggle, a very dark period. And when the Shah reached power, he was very friendly to the West and Israel. For lack of a better term, he was a puppet. He was backed by the US, they sold him weapons. He even passed a law stipulating that no US troops stationed in Iran could be prosecuted. He just gave them complete immunity. The United States sold more weapons to the Shah's Iran than any other country at the time, just to put that in perspective for you. While many people in Iran were suffering, Shah was living a very lavish life, busy throwing around money. He spent exorbitant sums of money on one single party. He built a city in the ancient city of Persepolis, invited loads of foreign dignitaries, and housed them in custom-built luxury apartments. No one knows the real cost of the party. Estimates range from $17 million all the way to $100. And so this lavish lifestyle that the Shah was living while people were suffering in Iran, this repression of Savak by the secret police, and this selling out Iran to the Americans and the Europeans, all of this together contributed to widespread resentment of the Shah, and it fanned the flames of revolution. Protests and movements to oppose the Shah began to spring up in late 1977 and grew rapidly. So we're talking about a very, very broad coalition, and that's important to understand because that's what makes the revolution a popular uprising and something that truly comes from the people. It's believed that around 10% of Iranians were demonstrating against the Shah, which is, it's frankly incredible because usually it's nowhere near as much. So you see the plurality of the uprising by the Iranian people against the Western-backed monarchy. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians taking to the streets in mass protests. In an attempt to stop this, the Shah declared martial law, but once it became clear there was no way he could quell the uprising, he left on vacation, never to return. And so February 1st, 1979, Imam Khomeini, leader of the revolution, was finally able to return after being exiled by the Shah for 15 years. Literally, over a million people took to the streets in a show of support. Shortly after, an Islamic Republic was established, national referendum, and the adoption of a constitution, and this marked the beginning of a new era. One of the core principles of the Iranian revolution is the idea of oppressed versus oppressor, and this is not only important because it relates to the people overcoming the oppression of the Shah and colonial influence. This theme is also important because it's derived from religious contexts. So when we talk about the Mustada'ifin, oppressed, and the Mustakbirin, the oppressor, many Iranians look to the Battle of Karbala, where Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was martyred in Iraq in the 7th century. And so this is another reason why one of the Islamic Republic's core beliefs and the ideology of the revolution is rooted in resistance and defend the oppressed. And so this belief was then translated into Iranian foreign policy. So it wasn't just about fighting oppression at home in Iran, but also about helping others outside Iran to fight their oppressors as well. And this is why one of the most compelling aspects of the Iranian revolution is its effect on surrounding countries and even the world at large. Let's look at Lebanon, for example. In 1982, 3 years after the Iranian revolution, Israel invades Lebanon. And shortly afterwards, Hezbollah was created. Hezbollah is a Lebanese resistance group. It has both a political and a military wing. And it was created with the purpose of resisting Israel's illegal occupation of South Lebanon. Ultimately, the Israelis would be kicked out and forced to withdraw in the year 2000. And then Israel invaded Lebanon again in 2006. But this time the Israelis were met with a blistering military response, which caught them completely off guard. So where did Hezbollah come from? And why was it so successful in defeating Israelis and kicking them out of South Lebanon and liberating Lebanon? The answer is Iran. Iran helped Hezbollah take shape as an organization, helped grow, provided it with training, weapons, and tools to fight against the Israeli colonizers. Hezbollah has always said that its military victories and liberation of the South are not just for one group or one sect, but for all of Lebanon. And in 2006, the 33-day war was a huge, huge military victory for Hezbollah. Many of the new weapons and technology which they used were provided by Iran. Such was the shock that Israel has never bombed Lebanon since. Now, more recently, in 2021, we saw Hezbollah bringing in truckloads of fuel into Lebanon to mitigate the economic crisis and the de facto American siege. This fuel was distributed by Hezbollah to orphanages, hospitals, and those who are most in need, completely free of charge. Who provided this fuel? Again, Iran. So yeah, this dynamic here of helping the oppressed overcome the oppressor, it extends far beyond Iran's borders. Let's look at Syria. Syria, where I was born, was in big trouble and about to fall to Daesh. Not just Daesh, but a lot of terrorist groups like Falaq al-Rahman, Jaish al-Islam, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, all of these funded by one country or another, the US, Saudi Arabia, and so on. And when Syria was just about to fall to these head-chopping maniacs, what did Iran do? Iran didn't just sit on the sidelines. It came to help Syria liberate itself from the onslaught of fiery terrorists. It came to liberate Syria from Al-Qaeda and Daesh and these terrorists that were sent our way. Let's look at Palestine. Palestine, which has been under Israeli occupation since 1948. Who is defending Palestine? Look around you today. Where are the Saudis? Where are the Emiratis? Where are the Bahrainis? Where are the Arabs? Not the people, but the government. The governments, many of the Arab governments and heads of states, they have abandoned the Palestinians, and it is shameful. Iran is not even an Arab country, and Iran supports the Palestinian cause more than some Arab countries. Hamas, which is in power in the Gaza Strip since 2006, has enjoyed an extensive relationship with Iran, extensive support from Iran, and continues to enjoy that support to this day. Let's look at Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Look at how many weapons the Saudis have bought. $115 billion worth of weapons from Obama. $300 billion worth of weapons from Trump. Billions and billions they've spent on weapons to use against Yemen, to commit genocide against Yemen. Not one of these Western countries that talk about human rights has stood with Yemen. Where's the UK? Where's Canada? Where's France? Where's Germany? All of them profiting off of the war. How many of them are standing with Yemen? Not just in saying, oh, the war is bad, genocide is bad, but actually standing with Yemen, supporting the Yemenis and their resistance. Very few. And Iran is one of them. Iran is one of the few actually standing behind the Houthis, behind Ansar Allah. So you're starting to see the difference, aren't you? All of this support is rooted in the Iranian Revolution of 1979. You have a country, an Islamic Republic, that's standing up not just for itself, but also helping others to overcome their oppressors. Stay tuned, we'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now is John White, a Scotland-based writer and political commentator. He's written for numerous outlets, including Morning Star, The Huffington Post, The Independent, and The Foreign Policy Journal. Thank you so much for coming to the program. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I want to start out with a more general question about the Iranian revolution before we get into specifics. Why do you think this is one of the most consequential events in modern political history?
It certainly changed the game in the Middle East and even beyond. And the evidence for that is the way that it still strikes terror in the hearts of Western ideologues with regards to their unrelenting attempts to roll it back with sanctions, with terror attacks, trying to isolate Iran, trying to marginalise Iran, trying to push back against Iran's influence. It was none other than Dostoevsky who once made the point that the best way to stop a prisoner from escaping is to make sure he never knows that he's in prison. And this is the way that elites govern in countries that govern in the interests of elites rather than the masses. And when the prisoners, i.e. the masses, wake up to the fact that they are in prison, that's when revolutions occur. And that's what happened in Iran in 1979 after decades of oppression under the Shah Ahmad Reza Pahlavi, a US placeman, a US agent. And it blew out of the water US grand strategy at the time under the Nixon doctrine, which was a twin pillar approach to dominating the Middle East through the says of applying government in Iran and applying government in Riyadh. And so it set back on its heels US grand strategy. And the Iranian revolution has caused a huge upheaval in capitals, not just in the region, but also, more importantly, in the West. So the Iranian revolution has had many, many effects. Their alliance with Venezuela, with Cuba, the linking up with Russia. It's been a major milestone on the way to a multipolar world. And I think its effects will be felt for many years to come.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting point. You touched on some of the things that I wanted to ask you about, which is, you know, people tend to analyze revolutions internally. But when we look at the Iranian revolution, it's had a lot of influence externally. You mentioned Venezuela, you mentioned Syria, you mentioned Lebanon and their residents. Why do you think that this is something that's a product of the Iranian revolution? Is this something that's a core principle? It's something that they believe in to help the downtrodden, to people who are under occupation, even all the way inland?
The most special thing about the Iranian revolution is its own sectarian character. Because obviously Iran's a Shia country or Shia-dominated country, that does not mean it articulates its politics on those terms. It articulates its stand on terms of the oppressed versus oppressor. And the Iranian governments, post-revolutionary governments, have stood firmly on the side of the oppressed, whether it's the Hamas in Palestine, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Cuba, whether it's the Irish Republican movement, whether it's the Syrian Arab Republic in terms of the onslaught that it faced from the tidal wave of Salafi jihadi counter-revolutionary forces on the back of the Iraq war and occupation by the US and its allies. So this non-sectarian character which makes it so, so special, because a revolution has by definition to be non-sectarian because it has to be on the side of the oppressed. And that's what the Iranian revolution has stood for. And by the way, it's came at a heavy price for the Iranians. I mean, the kind of resources that they've extended to help the Lebanese people struggle against Israeli aggression, to the Syrian Arab Republic, to Venezuela, etc., etc., it's come at a heavy, heavy price. And that speaks to the level of political consciousness that lies at the heart of that revolution and its impulse around the world.
The way that the revolution is viewed around the world tends to differ, right? How do you think that the revolution is viewed by Iran's neighbors versus how Europe views the revolution, how the United States views it? It's quite a substantial difference, isn't it?
Indeed. I think the neighbors see it favorably, obviously. Whether talking about the people of Yemen, the people of Syria, the people of Lebanon, the people of Palestine. But in the West, they've tried to paint Iran as some kind of dark Islamic hellhole, you know, and it's very Islamophobic. But this is the best tribute to Islam, the Iranian revolution, because, as I say, it's non-sectarian. It has allies who are non-Muslim, allies who are Sunni. It's on the side of anybody who happens to be oppressed unequivocally. And so, yeah, there is this attempt in the West, and it succeeded, I hate to say it, because of all these think tanks and all the anti-Islamic press that obtains in the West and painting it as some kind of reactionary development, and Iran is some kind of dark power. But in truth, Iran is a light, is one of the few lights in our world, along with China, along with Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, etc., against the dark powers of Western hegemony. And that's why they can't understand it. Iran's crime in state capitals in the West is that it doesn't bow. That's it. Despite all the bluster, this propaganda, Iran refuses to bow to Western hegemony. And that's why it's so demonized and so attacked.
What do you think is one of the most misunderstood aspects of the Iranian revolution, not just in 1979, but you know, all the way through to the present day?
Well, it was an emancipatory project. It has an Islamic, obviously, context, but in an emancipatory sense, because it understood that the masses are where the locus of power should reside, not with the elites, not with the megalomania of a kind of obscene ostentation, with the humility that comes from Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, this man in exile in Paris, through cassette tape, was able to stir the mass in Iran. He was the very epitome of the mantra of cometh the time, cometh the man. And so the Iranian revolution is a wonderful tribute to the possibility of a masses empowered by an ideology, Shia Islam, but it became a material force and it's adapted to the modern age. That's his beauty and that's his enduring truth.
You know, under the Shah, Iran had ties with Israel, being that it was sort of, you know, a US-UK party. And of course, that was flipped on its head by the revolution. Just very simply, is that one of the reasons that Israel and Iran are at such odds? They no longer have someone who can play the regional policeman for them.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of fact that after the Iranian revolution, the US ploughed huge resources into bolstering Israel and obviously the Saudis. Don't forget, the Saudis, under King Faisal, 1973, instituted the first oil shock, the embargo, Yom Kippur War. That's when the Saudis were a government that was actually on the side of the Arabs rather than the side of the West. And since then, the American policy, the grand strategy has been to keep Saudi Arabia close and keep Israel even closer because it needs these two powers to try and maintain its fading domination in the region. Iran is a beacon of hope for the future. We have an arc of resistance, the axis of resistance, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran, and it's grown ever, ever stronger. And I think it is coming soon when Iran is hegemonic power in the region. Not hegemonic in a negative sense, but in a positive sense, on the side of S, and then on the side of stability and security for all.
And just as a last question, if we can maybe go back a bit in time, the 1953 coup, when the US and UK, right, they took out the Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh and they brought the Shah back to power. How instrumental do you think all of this was in molding Iran's future, the events that led up to the revolution, and the way that Iranians view the United States and the UK today?
I think that was a main driving force behind the revolution. I think that informed political consciousness among the masses. They understood what happened to Mossadegh. It was a great crime. It's a historical crime. And I think the revolution was, in large part, a revenge for that horrible crime against Mossadegh, a democratically elected leader whose only crime, in the eyes of the West, was to nationalise Iran's oil in the interests of its people rather than Western oil companies. So the Iranian revolution was given extra impetus on the back of that knowledge and that historical crime. And I think the Iranian people will never forget. And there's one thing, obviously, I'm not getting into Iran's domestic situation because I don't live there and I don't feel I have the right to comment. I'm talking about foreign policy. But one thing that will unite Iranian people is any attempt by the US or its allies or regional powers to try and interfere in Iran's domestic policy, domestic politics. And I think that despite the depredation of the sanctions, again, the most severe ever imposed on any country, the Iranian people are strong, united when it comes to understanding the role of the US in their history, the malign role of the US and its allies in their history. And they will never be quashed. They're just far too powerful, morally, spiritually, and materially.
Iran doesn't gain anything material from supporting Palestinians. It doesn't gain anything material from supporting Syria, especially when Syria is being demonized. It doesn't gain anything material from backing Venezuela or Cuba. If anything, it actually costs Iran money to stick its neck out like that to support Hezbollah. Because then Iran is subjected to more sanctions. They call Iran a state sponsor of terrorism. They vilify Iran in the press and so on. And you see, that's the difference here. That's the difference between Iran and the US. Because the US buddies up with countries in order to sell them weapons so the corporations and the arms dealers can make money, can rake in big profits. Iran is not interested in profits. It's interested in principles, in developing long-lasting, meaningful alliances and reaching out to the downtrodden, to people who are resisting oppression. The axis of resistance isn't just stronger today than ever before, thanks to Iran. It might not have even existed if it weren't for Iran. War hawk and neoconservative John Bolton once said that the Iranian Revolution wouldn't get past its 40th anniversary. Well, look how that turned out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
UK exports of goods to the European Union have fallen by £20 billion compared with the last period of stable trade with Europe, according to official figures marking the first full year since Brexit. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economic correspondent, Richard Partington. The piece is titled UK exports to EU fell by £20 billion last year, new ONS data shows. UK exports of goods to the European Union have fallen by £20 billion compared with the last period of stable trade with Europe, according to official figures marking the first full year since Brexit. Numbers released on Friday, 11th of February, by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, showed that the combined impact of the pandemic and Britain's exit from the single market caused a 12% fall in exports between January and December of last year, compared with 2018. Highlighting the disproportionate impact of leaving the European Union, exports to the rest of the world, excluding the 27-nation bloc, dropped by a much smaller £10 billion, or about 6%, compared with 2018 levels. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, compared trade performance against figures from 3 years ago, because that was the last year before distortions caused by firms stockpiling ahead of Brexit deadlines and the spread of COVID-19. Despite the disruption, the European Union remains the United Kingdom's largest trading partner. However, for the first time since comparable records began in 1997, the United Kingdom now spends more importing goods from the rest of the world than it does from the European Union. UK goods imported from the European Union were down almost 17%, or about £45 billion, compared with 2018. In comparison, imports from the rest of the world increased by almost 13%, or about £28 billion. With the European Union accounting for just over half of UK exports worldwide, economists said Brexit was serving as an extra headwind for Britain, compounding the disruption from COVID-19 being felt across advanced economies. UK exporters are continuing to lose market share, said Gabriella Dickens, an economist at the consultancy firm Pantheon Macroeconomics. Although trade levels have picked up in recent months, data from the Netherlands Bureau for Economic Policy Analysis show that real good exports from advanced economies were 3.8% above their 2018 average in November, outpacing the United Kingdom. The hardest hit commodities recorded dramatic falls. Outbound shipments of clothing and footwear to the European Union were both down by almost 60%, compared with 2018 levels. Food and live animal exports, for which more stringent border checks are required, were down almost 18%, while vegetable exports dropped by almost 40%. Shipments of cars to the European Union, heavily disrupted by global supply chain issues and by COVID, were down by a quarter. Guillermo Larbalestier, a trade economist at the University of Sussex, said the drop in vegetable exports was probably linked to a fall in the number of seasonal workers available to pick and process crops. More burdensome paperwork and the difficulty in exporting perishable goods in the face of extended delays at the border. Clothing exports have been affected because a high proportion of garments sold by UK retailers are made in Asia or the United States, making them ineligible for the tariffs negotiated in the post-Brexit trade deal. However, the latest figures do suggest a recovery from the worst of the Brexit damage seen in January of 2021, just after Britain's departure, when exports to the European Union plunged by as much as 40%. According to the latest figures, UK exports to the European Union were about £200 million higher in December of 2021 than the same month in 2018.